Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, welcome everybody to the Kindling's Muse at the Movies, intelligent, imaginative, hospitable explorations of ideas that matter in today's film world. Over the next 30 minutes, we're going to discuss some current releases, a few new DVD releases, and some classics every thoughtful film goer should see, at least in the opinion of our esteemed guests, who are Jeffrey Overstreet, film critic and author of Aurelia's Colors and Through a Screen Darkly, Jenny Spohr, film producer and producer of The Kindling's Muse, and Greg Wright, senior editor of HollywoodJesus.com, author of Tolkien in Perspective, Sifting the Gold from the Glitter, and Peter Jackson in Perspective, the power behind cinema's The Lord of the Rings. And thank you, each of you, for being with us today.
Great. Thanks, Dick.
It's good to be back.
Since we're just getting started, really quickly, tell me how you first realized that you loved film. How did that happen for you, Greg?
Probably the first real experience I had with that was when my dad, and this is a weird thing because my father took us to see films about once every 4 years, maybe. took us to see a William Friedkin film named A Sorcerer. It was a very abstract film, a remake of the French film The Wages of Fear.
Wow.
Which is a very famous film. It blew my mind. I had no idea that films could be like that. Probably 14.
Really?
I was raised on the very cerebral, kind of emotionally cold films of David Lean. So I knew what real art looked like.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that that film could be something as visceral as a William Friedkin film.
What did that make you want to do with film in your life?
Well, that just got me started thinking a lot more about it. And then when I went to college and was able to see Apocalypse Now in the context of a University of Washington think tank environment several times, that really started making me deal with film a lot more at an intellectual level as opposed to just entertainment.
Interesting. Now, Jenny, how did you get hooked on film?
You know, what pops to my mind is seeing Indiana Jones, the very first one, at the John Dance Theater in Bellevue, Washington, a huge one-screen theater, and the entire audience, this was the first time I'd experienced the entire audience being so hooked viscerally to a film, literally cheering and throwing their arms up in the air. Everyone was caught in this experience, just enveloped into this really fun romp of a movie, and I realized, wow, film has not only power, but it can have a lot of fun as well.
Interesting. And Jeffrey Overstreet.
Well, I'll come at this from a funny angle. When I was in school, I would go to the library and look at books. And I went to a Christian school, and in many of the classic books, like Huckleberry Finn, lines had been crossed out with a black Sharpie so that we wouldn't see certain words or know that they existed at a young age. In the same way, the Baptist church community I grew up in was very suspicious of movies, didn't think people should go to movies, and as a result, I became incredibly curious about them. And just like I would hold up those pages to the light and try and see what the words were through the Sharpie ink. And so I would spend hours reading reviews in the newspaper and looking at the ads for those movies in the newspaper and wondering what those characters were about, wondering what happened in those stories.
So all you wanted to see what was behind the Sharpies.
Exactly. I wanted to know.
It's a great strategy, parents everywhere.
Yeah. What was behind those locked doors? And so when I finally got to see Star Wars, and it blew my mind, I was just the right time. 7 years old, 1977. You couldn't help but have your life changed in the theater by having your uncle sneak you in to see Star Wars.
The DVD fast forward is the equivalent of the Sharpie for today's fundamentalist.
It is.
Because parents are there quickly trying to fast forward through the bad scenes and then pausing to make sure it's okay. And
well, now they have DVD players that have been designed to do that for them, to cut out all the nasty bits.
Yeah. Isn't that wonderful? Revival has broken out in DVD land. Let's talk about some current releases and some of the things that people might not be thinking about, because a lot of people still view film just as kind of entertainment. They go, they see, they laugh, they cry, they leave. And they haven't really thought about what some of the themes or ideas might be that they should be interacting with. And you guys chose the movies, and well, the first one, if people don't see that there's some meaning in this movie, I don't know what we're going to do. Ratatouille. Who wants to go first in telling us what you were connecting to and what the ideas were that were worth discussing in that movie?
Well, some people have joked that Ratatouille is custom made to make critics happy, because it's all about being discerning and critical and paying attention to excellence. And Remy the Rat loves food so much, good food, so much, as opposed to the trash that his family eats, that critics right away, I think, sympathize with him. And there's that whole sense of trying to awaken your friends to what you think is great. And I think everybody can relate to this on some level. For some people, it's sports. They see something in a football game that other people are just like, oh, it's just another football game. For some of it's food. For some of it's art.
Yeah.
It could be anything. But that moment when Remy tries to awaken his thick-headed friend, Emile, here's a grape, here's a piece of cheese. Eat them together and just experience what happens. And you know from watching the movie that when Remy eats something great,
yeah,
the 4th of July breaks out over his head. You see all these bright colors representing what he is experiencing.
Right.
Emile takes a bite of it, and there's this poof off to the side of his head, and it just sort of drifts away like a light bulb going out. And he goes, nap. No big deal. And he just eats the whole thing in one bite. And we've all sensed that frustration of, why can't our friends and family understand what I appreciate?
Yeah. Greg, what do you think?
Well, as a critic, you go to... at least I do. I know there are some critics who aren't the same. You go to press screenings, and you put on your objective cap, and you try to keep it on as long as possible. Even though I was enjoying Ratatouille immensely as the first part of the movie progressed, I was still managing to keep my cap of objectivity on, and then completely lost it in the final third of the movie when they finally started to delve into the Anton Ego character in
yes.
depth. And the moment at which he sinks his teeth into a bite of the ratatouille, that moment sold me.
And because for those that haven't seen it, he's a critic.
He's a
so
critic.
So you're a film critic watching a critic
yep.
and being swept up in...
Because it was just this awareness on the filmmaker's parts of that every critic, and whether it's an armchair critic or a professional critic, every critic basically is just reliving moments of childhood
yeah.
and connecting with some magical thing that they either... fondly recall or something they lost.
Yeah.
And for Anton Ego, that's what it was. Is he reconnected with, you know, that moment in childhood with his mother and so I was totally sold. I thought, you know, it's always self-awareness. There's always kind of this arch level of quasi-satire that's involved in these sorts of things. But when they really connect with something that's real and that is going on at some level with everybody that watches a movie, I say, fine, whatever shortcomings there might have been there, I'm going to forgive them.
Now, is this a movie that operates, it obviously operates at many levels, and yet it's a movie, and I'm thinking about this because of the recent death of Madeleine L'Engle, who said, if something's too complicated, then you've got to write it for children. You know, and so this is a movie that children can certainly connect to and have a great time at. Do children get the point, like, you got the point with the critic and the... Do you think that it has that ability to kind of get them into a serious idea? Or does it operate at multiple levels, one of which is more for the kid and the other is the adult watching the film?
I think it's more at multiple levels. Yeah, I don't think kids are going to click at that level with the film. But it succeeds so well as children's entertainment without all of the knowing
yeah.
adult humor kinds of things that kids' comedies usually build into them that... I think kids will be totally sold on it.
I actually, Jenny, you want to say something?
Well, you know, I talked to a couple of people who have kids, and I think it's a bit more of an older kid genre movie. I think a lot of parents wanted it to be more Shrek, that's sort of younger children, but sort of for some 4 and 5 year olds, it went over their heads and they got restless. My little nephew, who's 4, couldn't sit through it. There just wasn't as much action and sort of the physical comedy that you see in a lot
but
of
what
other...
Does that say something about the film or about today's film goer?
That's
because
it.
Shrek
Correct.
is an yeah. edgy movie,
yeah.
whereas Ratatouille was a sweet movie.
Ratatouille is more traditional, and it's for people who will sit still and give a story a chance to prove itself instead of trying to please you at every
instead
single moment.
Instead of constantly exactly. going, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which is why we like the movie.
Yeah.
More
mm-hmm.
than a lot. It's funny, though. I attended the movie with one of my kids and sat next to a couple who I think they said they had 8 children, one of whom was developmentally disabled. And what they did is went and previewed movies to find out whether they were going to be good for their kids. So, and it was at a theater that had a lot of young kids at it, and I thought the young kids connected to it. So it's an interesting movie and a good example of a movie that that can get at a serious idea in an entertaining way. Now, you guys put Bourne Ultimatum on the list of movies that are dealing with some ideas that matter. And a lot of people think that Bourne Ultimatum is basically just a, you know, action flick, an adventure flick. How did this get on the list?
Well, I had a bit of a Bourne overload when I saw this. I couldn't remember the first two. I vaguely remember, but I didn't remember why he didn't remember anything, Jason Bourne, this character who has amnesia. And so I watched the first two literally right before going to the third one and thought the third one was the best of all three. But I really connected with the struggle of this guy who has completely no idea who he is, why he's here. A woman he desperately loves has been killed in the other films, and he's a part of a world he doesn't understand, and he's trying to make sense of it. He's trying to make sense of who he is and who the world is in the midst of a world that is destructive and violent and frightening. And I connected to that on a level of feeling that way myself sometimes. Who am I in this world that can be violent and destructive and confusing, and how do I find my own path to, frankly, who God wants me to be as a Christian, who God wants me to be, as well as how I can represent myself.
Did you guys see some deeper meaning in the film?
And I think the reason that people see those sorts of things in Jason Bourne is because he's an idealized self for us all. Because having his slate wiped clean, he doesn't have the levels of moral complexity that we all deal with on a daily basis. Even though he remembers nothing, he still has in him this innate sense of, hey, this isn't right. Yeah. And so he never engages deliberately in any act that he knows to be wrong. He may do some stupid stuff or some wrong stuff, but it's not out of evil intent. And I think that's why audiences really connect with Jason Bourne as a character, and particularly the movies that are fairly well done, is because of this ability for us to throw off our own moral ambiguity and see a character that says, this is what it looks like for somebody to actually just 100% be focused on trying to find out the truth.
Yeah.
Without all this other stuff getting in the way.
Except that he kills a lot of people in the process. I mean, he was morally ambiguous about his ultimate, how he got this way. But in order to resolve it, he had to stay that way.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting point.
That can be seen as a metaphor for a person simply being aware that they are fundamentally sinful. You know, that there's this built-in thing and they don't understand, why do I have these sinful tendencies?
Yeah.
And he's seeking the truth, trying to figure out, how did I get that way?
Okay. Now,
why
for
am
somebody
I that
way? Just traced across this website and is listening to this podcast and saying, what in the heck are these guys talking about? I mean, are there people that are going to hear what we're saying and believe we're reading into a movie the issues that matter to us, that the filmmaker didn't intend them, the screenwriter didn't intend them, it's not the intent of the movie, it's just when religious or idea-oriented people watch movies, they find things there?
Well, absolutely there will be people that say that. And there will be people who go to the movie and all they get out of it is enjoyment from the cheap thrills. But I think the question is, why do we go back to this one again and again and again? And why do we admire this character? Why do we find him so charismatic when he's not funny?
Yeah.
He's not romancing women right and left. Mm-hmm. He's not glamorous. He really is the inevitable reaction to James Bond.
Okay.
We are tired of the lie that an admirable fellow is a person who goes out and indulges in all these things and gets his way every time and can do this with the ultimate cool. And Bourne is bewildered and alarmed at his own violent reactions to things.
Okay.
I think people are starting to ask some questions of conscience, even if they don't realize it, and say, what is it about this guy that's more interesting?
Okay, now speaking of more interesting and admirable characters, The Simpsons, Homer Simpson. Now, this is a television series that has been kind of elevated in its esteem as a place where there's some serious theology happening and some serious religious issues being dealt with. Did that follow through into the movie? Is the movie commending itself to us, not just because it's entertaining, but because it actually is dealing with something that is important?
I think it's just so observant. I mean, for me, the great moment in the film, and everybody will probably have a different great moment, but for me, the great moment comes when Springfield as a whole realizes that they are about to be insulated in a plastic bubble. and they see this giant bubble coming in the sky, carried by helicopters to be dropped over them and lock them away from the rest of the world because they're so polluted and they're just going to choke on their own fumes, literally. And we get this aerial view of Mo's bar and the church. And the churchgoers run out, and the customers at the bar run out, and they look up and see their doom coming, and everyone screams, and the churchgoers run into the bar, and the bar customers run into the church. That is such a brilliant observation of the way people tend to be,
okay.
That the whole audience laughed, and that's because they recognize it. And that's why I think The Simpsons has lasted as long as it has, is it's not just trying to please us. It's doing what a lot of great art does, however crassly, by holding up a mirror to reality and saying, look at yourselves. And, okay, it's a funhouse mirror. It's distorting it so we laugh at ourselves because it's exaggerating our flaws. But that does send us away a little wiser.
Yeah. I really liked that the movie as well, finally, the characters in the film that we've come to love over so many years on TV are looking at themselves in the mirror as well. You know, Homer is coming to a realization of what sort of adult he really is, and he's not really the best father in the world, and is more attached to a pig than to his family. Lisa finally meets a boy who's not a complete dork, but actually likes her, and you know, the characters are coming into realizations of their own, which is fun to watch and satisfying as well.
Greg, you want to add anything on The Simpsons?
Well, I just think that the other thing that's underlying The Simpsons is great satire. Both Matt Groening on his own and James L. Brooks, who's his collaborator, are both great satirists in their own right. And it's because they are able to have insight into human nature, human behavior. And so either, well, you may not like what you see in the characters or, you know, the subjects of the show on The Simpsons, but there's no denying that the people behind the show are understanding what's going on in our culture, and they're able to stick a stick into everybody and prod everybody a little bit, pretty even-handedly. They don't give a free pass to anybody.
I like the themes that are emerging here because they're the themes I think that we would all believe filmgoers should represent, which is observant and insight. You should be able to observe a film, and you should gain insight in as you're watching a film. Let's look at some recent films or recent DVD releases. Hot Fuzz. Was there one of you in particular that loved that movie that wants to tell us why it's important?
Well, it's great satire, like The Simpsons. Only it's joking on American action movies specifically. And I'd just like to throw in my two cents on the greatest film cameo of all time that 99% of the audience didn't even see. If you don't know who's behind that mask, when Simon Pegg goes to confront his ex-girlfriend, go back and watch that scene again because that's a very, very clever cameo, and I don't want to spoil it for you.
And, of course, I was sitting next to Jeffrey in the screening on that one, and he said, isn't that so-and-so? And I said, huh?
So much for observance.
I'd missed it. You know, I'm usually really good with voices, too, so I could have been blind, and I might have caught it sooner.
That's a film that a lot of people are going to miss. A lot of people aren't going to see that film.
Well, and I have to caution people about that too, because there's another film out there that comparisons have been drawn to because it does a lot of the same things, is also very violent, and also ostensibly claims to be a satire, and that's Shoot 'Em Up, which was released a couple of weeks ago, and there is no comparison between the two films. Mm. I found Shoot 'Em Up, if anybody has seen that or read things about it, to be an incredibly bad-natured, mean-spirited film. And Hot Fuzz was not that way for me. I sat down to watch Hot Fuzz, and even though there was violence in it, you could sense that behind it, the guys that made the film were having fun, and it was good-natured humor.
Yes.
As much as violence can be good-natured.
Yeah.
It was good-natured humor.
Well,
it wasn't
they have
mean.
Affection. It's obvious they have affection for all of their characters, including the villains,
yes.
which is always a good sign that you're in the hands of a great storyteller.
Painted Veil. Who wants to tell us about Painted Veil and why people should be watching that film?
That's a shift.
Wow, whiplash.
Exactly. The Painted Veil, one, is just beautiful to watch. It's beautiful to watch.
Yes.
But it's a story, it's a love story that does not take the traditional route. And it's talking about things that I find important in the world. They go to a cholera epidemic in China. And the lead character is trying to figure out how to contain cholera there. And so you're delving into, here are people who are very rich English people going to try and help something in a third world, but then the wife isn't isn't there because she wants to be, and that it becomes to me a love story between the husband and wife, but also a love story with people who are hurting.
Let's talk, because we said Whiplash, about media diet, because here we've gone from Hot Fuzz to Painted Veil, and they're completely different movies.
Yes.
And people have limited amount of time, and they're listening to us talk about Ratatouille, Bourne, Ultimatum, Simpsons, Hot Fuzz, Painted Veil, Manufactured Landscapes is next. How do people decide what to put in their media diet? How do when they're looking at all these different choices and they're hearing us talk about them, should you have a balance? Should you be looking for variety? Should you lock into the things that you like? What do you think?
Well, I think on one level, awareness is part of it. People need to find a voice that they can trust to kind of give them a little bit of a guide into what might or might not be seen. But also, you know, I just saw a documentary today that I expected to hate because I knew nothing about it. And I won't tell you what it is. But the experience that I have as a critic is so often I see films that I know nothing about, and I try to know as little about them as I can before I go in. You end up seeing a lot of dogs. But the experience of not knowing what you're about to see is sometimes far more rewarding than knowing what you see in advance. So that's one thing to consider.
So what is your advice? Because you guys do reviews online that people can go read in advance of seeing a movie, and you are trusted guides to a lot of people, but you're also now saying one of the great experiences is to go in and be surprised.
Well, you have to know yourself, I think, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
very good.
Know your own tastes, know how you react to things that are unexpected. If you react poorly to unexpected things, maybe you don't want to do what I do.
Yeah.
And try to know as little going in.
Yeah.
If you want more safety, you know, there are resources out there. You can go to certain websites that tell you all the nasty things that you might see.
And I think if you pay attention to what intrigues you, a lot of the best movies I've ever seen, a lot of my favorites, have only become favorites after I've seen them six or seven times, because even though I didn't walk out of the theater going, wow, that was great, 6 months later, I'm still chewing on something about that movie. Pay
exactly.
attention to
The Weeping Camel.
Yes.
The story of Weeping Camel.
The story. When you recommended that, I went immediately and rented it, and I took it home to my family. And our son, Josh, who, by the way, just got hired by Disney, but he just loved it. I mean, he couldn't stop talking about it. The next morning, he was going on and on about it. And I'm not going to name names, but there were people that watched the whole thing and said, huh? You know? But it was one of those surprise. All I knew was you said you should see it, and so I did. What do we do with word of mouth? Because word of mouth is actually one of the primary ways online that people are deciding what they're going to see. I get an email out of the blue from a guy in Chicago, actually lives in Indiana, but listened to my show in Chicago. And he was called Orthodox Mitch because he had converted to Antiochian Orthodoxy. And he says, there's a movie called Once. Mm. You've got to go see it.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. So I went and saw it. Now, I don't know what a kind of trusted guide he was, but should people be asking questions when their friends say, hey, go see this movie?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I think that we especially if you're paying attention to who's recommending it.
Yes. That's what I was going to say. Depends on the friend.
You learn to trust certain people, certain critics. This is why I really recommend that people read reviews, even of the movies they're not interested in, because you discover, you may not end up liking that movie, but you discover a sensibility behind the name of the critic, or even the name of the director, or even the name of the actor.
Yeah.
You start to trust their choices and their careers as to what projects they'll sign on to.
Or even production houses as well.
I'll go see anything Ed Norton stars in because he's been very careful to choose movies that will last.
Okay.
I grew up in Seattle reading William Arnold and John Hartle. And after I learned how to read William Arnold and John Hartle, I could read their reviews of the same movie and have almost a 100% chance of figuring out if I was going to enjoy the movie before I went to see it.
Good.
Because I knew... I started to learn their own biases and their own inclinations in rating movies.
Interesting.
And so I think following an approach or following a particular critic gives you a better chance of knowing if you're going to get the payoff.
Stephen Gradonis, who reviews films for decentfilms.com and for ChristianityTodayMovies.com, will come out of a theater and call me on his cell phone immediately and just say, Jeff, go see Ratatouille. That's all he has to say. I've read his reviews, and I know if he's calling me before he even gets in his car, this is going to change my life.
In just a moment, each of our guests will tell you where you can read their reviews, because they're going to each tell us a movie they think you ought to see. But before we get to their top picks that you ought to have seen, Manufactured Landscapes is on this list.
And I'll bet very few people have heard of it.
Yeah. It was one of those movies that I thought about for days and days afterwards. Because on the one level, it's a movie that tries to communicate a theme that's real common in documentaries these days, which is about the dangers of American consumerism, global consumerism, the damage that we're doing to our environment. But it deals with things on two different levels than you're used to getting it. One is it's almost abstract art, which is just fascinating. Now, either that's your thing or it isn't. If it isn't your thing, stay far away from it, because you'll probably fall asleep within the first tracking shot, which is 8 minutes long. on the other hand, if something abstract is your cup of tea, the second thing that it's going to do is talk about the cost of what happens in this world at the other end of the cycle, which is what happens when all these things that we consume get destroyed.
Yeah.
And I tell you, it completely changed my point of view on recycling 100%.
Really? Yeah. Interesting. And today I spent most of my day looking for a composter.
Yeah.
Now that I live on Orcas Island.
Yeah.
It's big out there.
Yeah.
It made me think about Ephesians 5:11, which sounds like a strange thing to say, but I kept thinking about that verse as I watched it. And the verse says, "Have nothing to do with the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them." Manufactured landscapes is constantly showing you spectacles in the real world in which people are producing things in such a way that the more you look at them, the more you realize the cost, like Greg was saying, of what's happening. And the picture itself starts to do a work on you. It starts to change you, like a surgeon exposing a tumor in a sick body.
Or you don't want to look at some part during a heart surgery.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to look at that. It's messy. It's ugly. But if you don't look at that, you're not going to understand something that is crucial for you to understand, to live a healthy life and to go on.
Our listenership just went way up because people love the Surgery Channel. and when you started using images of rib cages being pulled apart,
that brings us back to Hot Fuzz again.
Yeah, that's right.
So now we're going to conclude with each of our guests telling us the movie that they personally chose that you ought to see. And Jenny, you started with La Vie en Rose.
Yes, correct. And that is still out for some that you might be able to catch it at some small art house films. Theaters, and it is the quintessential art house film. It is long and it is French.
Yes. Woo-hoo!
But it tells a story of the amazing singer Edith Piaf, and I was a fan of hers before I came to the movie, so I was excited to see this. I knew nothing about her life, I just knew her amazing voice. And I thought that it speaks of a woman who is childlike and childish throughout her whole life. As a small child, she is basically raised for many years in a brothel. She's not working in the brothel, but she's been given to her grandmother. She's been adopted by these prostitutes. So here's a 5, 6 to 10 year old girl in this brothel. She grows up to be this French star, this amazing singer, and is very demanding and all these sorts of things. And yet she carries on this childlike throughout her life. At the end of the movie, and it goes back and forth in timeline, so it's a little bit confusing.
Yeah.
The end of the movie, she's interviewed, and the woman says, "What would you tell a young woman today?" And Edith Piaf says, "Love." And to look at a woman whose life is full of drugs and the death of the love of her life, and raised in this brothel, to say that love is the thing that you should capture in your life, spoke words to me.
Amazing.
That's a great choice.
Jeffrey Overstreet, first of all, tell us where people can read your reviews, and your latest book is
Aurelia's Colors,
which is a project that has taken a long time and has just come out.
It's a novel 10 years in the making, frankly, and it has nothing to do with the movie yet. John Sayles, if you're listening, I'd love to talk. But they can find my reviews at lookingcloser.org, lookingcloser.org. I had a book come out earlier this year about my experience at the movie theater called Through a Screen Darkly. And if I could do it over again, I would add this film to the ones I wanted that I discussed.
And your film is This Is England.
This Is England by director Shane Meadows. And let me begin by saying, please don't take your family to this film. It is about skinheads in London. They speak in relentless profanity. They are very violent. There's a lot of frank sexual discussion going on. But ultimately, it's about the cost of war that goes on after the war, that goes on in the lives of the children who grow up without their fathers or mothers who died in action. And you watch this 12-year-old boy in 1983, his name is Sean, played so incredibly well by a young actor named Thomas Turgoose, who I have a feeling we're going to be seeing a lot more from. But he's growing up so lonely and getting humiliated daily at school. And on his way to school one day, he runs into a gang of skinheads who surprisingly welcome him with kindness and companionship. And he finds a father figure there in a skinhead gang lord played by Stephen Graham, who really gives him respect and affection. And you can see that the gang lord is seeing his younger self in Sean. And you start to understand, as horrible as this all is, you start to understand why young people are drawn into this kind of thing, where gangs of skinheads come from. They come from communities where young people are desperate for camaraderie and companionship, and they can easily be united behind an idea. And these young men and women are united behind the idea that their country is being invaded by immigrants, which quickly leads to racism, quickly leads to violent protest. And you start to see practically news footage about what started happening there in the mid-80s in London. So there's a lot of history going on, but really it's timeless because it's about a child that desperately needs his father.
Wow.
And there's one moment where he walks by the Church of Christ, and that sign, Church of Christ, just shines over his head as if it's a neon sign, and the place is as empty as a tomb. And the irony is impossible to miss. No one is reaching out to him but the skinheads.
Yeah. And Gregory Wright, The King of Kong. First, tell us where we can read your reviews.
Well, my wife Jen and I are managing editors at HollywoodJesus.com. We don't write for the website anymore, although I still have a vast archive of Lord of the Rings related articles there at HollywoodJesus.com. We are also managing editors for a film site that's partnered with Gospelcom called Pass the Popcorn, which you can get to at ptpopcorn.com. And that's where my writing appears these days, at ptpopcorn. There are a lot of... King of Kong is subtitled Fistful of Quarters. It's a documentary, and it stands out in a field of really good documentaries. In fact, there are three of them coming out this Friday that I can also recommend heartily. Deep Water, which is about a guy that that faked his participation in a world around the world sailing trip, true story. The documentary on Pete Seeger, this is fantastic, that I would recommend to anybody who loves music. And then also a documentary about the NASA program In the Shadow of the Moon. But King of Kong is the rare film that I have recommended to just about anybody that's living or breathing. It's just fascinating as an insight into the gaming culture, which I think people need to be aware of today. If people aren't aware, a lot of people are saying, and I'm becoming a believer, that video gaming, computer gaming, is going to supplant the film industry as the dominant entertainment industry of the 21st century. I think it's going to happen. People need to be aware of why, what people are looking for, what they get out of gaming. And The King of Kong is interesting. It's just about two guys who are battling over the title of the world's record holder for Donkey Kong, which on one level sounds absolutely absurd, and it is. But that's half the fun of the movie. It's just fascinating to look at these characters and what motivates them.
This has been a lot of fun. You've been listening to The Kindlings Muse at the Movies, and you can check out more at the website thekindlings.com. And we'll have links to Jeffrey and Greg's review sites as well, so that you can enjoy more of their thoughts on other films. Thank you, Jeffrey Overstreet, Jenny Spohr, and Greg Wright for being with us. This is Dick Staub. Come back next time for more of The Kindlings Muse at the Movies.